Wes Craven is one of today's top horror film directors. His credits include Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Deadly Friend. Craven compares movie watching to dreaming. He said, when people go into a theater and they shut off the lights, it's as if they're entering the darkness of sleep and dreams. To me, a good horror film should be just that, a compelling dream. Craven's first film, Last House on the Left, advanced the genre to a new level of gruesome violence. It graphically and realistically depicted two teenage girls being raped, tortured, and killed by psychotic escaped convicts. The film truly horrified not only viewers, but industry insiders. Though it became a cult classic, it didn't win Craven contracts for major motion pictures. He made several more small genre films, which were praised by some critics for their eccentricity and ironic edge, and for how deeply felt his vision was. The box office success of Nightmare on Elm Street has allowed Craven to start to move beyond the genre. His new film, The Serpent and the Rainbow, is a suspense thriller scheduled to open in early February. The movie is set in Haiti and is based on the true story of a Harvard student who investigated the scientific basis of voodoo magic. I spoke to Wes Craven from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked him why he started to make horror movies, if he loved the genre, or if he just saw it as a way to break into the film industry.
As a matter of fact, I wasn't aware of the genre. I was simply trying to break into the film business, as everyone else is, waitresses and all. And a horror film was the first sort of film that was presented to me as an opportunity. I had no knowledge of them before that. I really did not. I was more immersing myself in the work of the European directors and the Fellinis and Bergmans and so forth. But I found I had an affinity for it that even surprised me. I didn't know until I started doing it that I could do it rather well.
So you were approached to do The Last House on the Left?
Yeah, that's right. I was working, just learning the film business. I was literally in the business about a year and a half from not knowing a thing about it. And I was working my way up through the editing room and got an opportunity to work on a small feature that allowed me to do some directing, some writing, and some editing at a point where I knew virtually nothing about making a cut or writing the script. And that film was successful, and as a result, the producer, who was Sean Cunningham at that time, a very, very young guy who was also just starting, Sean was offered by the distributor the chance of making a horror film for them to fill their summer bill. And Sean offered me the chance to write it, direct it, and cut it. We were close friends. We were working out of one small office on 45th Street in New York, and the two of us were going to set off and make this film for a very small amount of money. We made it for $90,000. And our entire concept was to maybe clear $10,000 out of the budget to pay our own home bills. And instead, the film caused a sensation and took off at the box office, and we became sort of notorious. And I was in one swell foop, a director of some sort.
Well, it caused a sensation because it was just so gruesome and realistic. You know, a lot of violence in horror movies is really very campy, and it doesn't really hurt. But the violence in Last House on the Left and the scenes of rape and mutilation and torture are so intense. I mean, I ended up walking out of the theater for that scene. I just felt that I didn't want to have to remember it if I saw it. And I wonder if that's the challenge that you took on for yourself, to make something more graphic and more realistic than it had ever been done before.
It was. It was very specifically the philosophy of it. You know, I had a certain ambivalence towards doing this sort of genre. As I said, it was not something that I loved. But I was intrigued by the idea of presenting anything that was exceptionally truthful, because I felt that most of the films that I'd seen that were made in America for popular audiences were distortions, and quite often would present violence in a way that was either operatic or balladic or simply elliptic, so that you know, you would fade away before any true violence was done, or the act of violence would be very simple and antiseptic. Someone would be shot, clutch his chest, and fall down and die. A stab wound, you know, always killed with the first thrust. And parallel to the process of filmmaking, in my own mind and in the minds of Sean too, were the mass of media inputs from the Vietnam War, and where we were seeing the first results of ourselves and the whole American public being exposed to the realities of war on a sort of real-time basis, whereas you saw people suffered. It wasn't edited. The government didn't have enough facilities to filter it all out, so that we were seeing reality of violence on our television sets, going into our theaters and seeing distorted, filtered reality. So that Sean and I set off to say simply, let's not cut away, and let's not do violence that is entertaining. And I didn't. You know, I simply did not cut away. And one stab did not do it, and one shot did not do it. And at the time that most other movies would cut away so people could safely ensconce themselves in the next scene and sort of forget about the reality of it, we kept going. And we did that within the format of a B-movie. Now, you know, we were two pretty mature men. We were 30 when we did this. We were not kids. We had a very real plan in mind. We were working within the basis of a B-movie, very almost cartoonish characters. But once the violence began, the violence was treated absolutely really. And thus the outrage. The audiences were, in a sense, tricked. They went into a movie expecting to be entertained in the pure action or horror sense, where the blood is ketchup and the violence is simple and cartoonish. And instead, we said, now that we've got you here, by the way, this is what violence is really like.
What's the benefits of seeing that, though?
I think the benefits of seeing that is that it reaffirms reality rather than reaffirming a fantasy. Too much of American cinema dealt with reaffirming fantasies. It was a Disney-like approach to the entire spectrum of our reality. And at the same time, in the real world, quote, whatever the hell that is, we were seeing more and more of the veils stripped away, you know. The myth of American supremacy and infallibility, the myth of, you know, bombs dropped to win wars and you don't see the people that they hit, the reality that the American soldier was heroic and in all cases and never did anything that was terribly disturbing. All those were being stripped away in the public forum, but in cinema, we're still desperately trying to reaffirm the myths. And my feeling was it's time to stop dreaming. And I guess that's become the theme of my entire work. It's time to wake up.
I think in some ways that Last House on the Left became a forerunner of slasher films. And I wonder if you think that other film directors have taken the kind of graphic violence that you started to extremes that you find disturbing.
Well, I don't think it really was a forerunner to slasher films. I mean, there were the films of Stuart Gordon a long time before I made Last House. I think it more or less stands on its own. I mean, the genre in the sense of, you know, a man with a knife has been around. Hitchcock did it. And, you know, Hitchcock always boasted that you never saw the knife touch the flesh. Well, in my mind, as good as Hitchcock was, and I would never deny his genius, he denied the essence of the moment. And I always go on, there was a French philosopher that once said, it's all right to lie, that's what art is all about, but it's not all right to lie about the essence of the matter. And I've used that as my credo making films.
So you don't think that other people have taken what you've done to extremes that disturb you?
No, I don't. I don't think other people are that weak or, you know, are artistic Xeroxes. I think everybody goes off and does their own vision, and I don't take responsibility for other people's work. Frankly, it's bad enough taking responsibility for my own.
Well, has that been hard? I mean, really, have people made false assumptions about you based on your movies?
I don't know whether they're false or true. I mean, you know, sometimes the truth hurts too. But I certainly have had my experiences of people getting up and walking away, not only from my movies, but from me. You know, I was anathema in polite society after I made Last House. People literally would grab their children and run from the room. And I always found it an irony that, you know, the same people that would support a war or, you know, live a lifestyle that would require entire third world countries to be put in near slavery would at the same time be appalled by somebody that did something that was only effective within a certain closed dark room called a movie house. It was very interesting.
Director,
but,
yeah.
Yes, I've experienced a great deal of you know, ostracism from making of films. It's only been in the last you know, 4 or 5 years that I've received real nice things from it.
Director Wes Craven is my guest You know, it seems to me that although you started doing this very almost documentary style portrayals of violence, that the violence in your movies has gotten more movie-like.
Mm-hmm.
In, for instance, Nightmare on Elm Street and Deadly Friend. I don't know if you'd agree with that. But
I would agree with it in the sense that, yeah, I've thought about it myself. I could give you lots of artistic reasons, but I've also wondered whether, as Lena Wertmüller once said, the one thing the artist must never lose is his rage. Maybe I've lost some of my rage. I don't know. I think Last House was specifically about real violence. I don't think of that film as a horror film. I think of horror films as sort of about not real life, you know, about the area of fantasy and dreams. Last House was about real violence that people really do to each other, and the capacity for it within the most staid, middle-classed breast. And that was why the tables turned in that movie, and at the end the parents were just as violent as the escaped psychopaths, you know. The later films, Nightmare on Elm Street, for instance, was much more about psychic consciousness, and I'm not into some sort of weird cult, or that I'm a very ordinary guy, but, you know, I feel very much like the real stakes that are going on in the planet, insofar as humankind is concerned, is consciousness. Are we going to be awake, or are we going to be asleep? And the only way to get rid of the boogeyman is to stay awake, not to fall asleep, not to try to dream him away.
Yeah, that's what happens in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Everyone's warned not to fall asleep because this group of teenagers share the same nightmare. They have this nightmare of a mutilated killer who attacks them in their dreams, but the attacks that he carries out in their dreams carry over into their real life. So when they're stabbed in their sleep, they bleed in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Is this in a way the fulfillment of your theory that horror films are like nightmares?
Well, I think it's more like I think our dreams become our realities. I carry it much more into waking life.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as our most subtle and unbounded imagination produces things, we must deal with them within real life. And insofar as we neglect them, whether they be horrific thoughts or tendencies or impulses or whatever, so to the extent that we neglect them and try to go off into the various exits that the characters in Nightmare used, except for the heroine, that is, sex, booze, family, solidity, whatever it might be, all those people were denying the reality and saying, you know, this is reality. Only one person was willing to face it, and that is the only person that survived. So I'm saying, you know, not that, nightmares are like dreams. It's our dreams must be dealt with. Our most innermost uncensored impulses must be dealt with, must be worked out in real life, within our lives. And that's, to me, the thrill of making films for a young audience is that I am sort of writing scenarios for the apocalypse. You know, I'm dealing with very primal, raw energies and trying to put some form on them. And I really, truly believe that that is, as much as anything else, why my audience likes my films. Not that they're just bloody and scary, although that is a thrill, but that they have some inner sense to them. They've been thought through, and they are not black. They're strangely hopeful. You know, my characters survive not because of some fluke of luck, but they survive because they figure out what's going on and they figure out a way to deal with it within the capacities of their human spirit. And they have to plumb to the very depths of it and come up with the best and the brightest of it. You know, Nancy doesn't kill Freddy at the end of Nightmare on Elm Street by picking up a bigger gun or inventing Star Wars. She kills him by turning her back on him. You know, and that's a pretty subtle and I think profound thought. It's not one that I came up with. You know, it's one that I found in my own readings and listenings. But, it's an important notion.
I want to talk more about your movies, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is film director Wes Craven. His movies include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, and Nightmare on Elm Street. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Wes Craven, who's joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. You said earlier on in our conversation that you initially didn't want to get into horror movies. It was just your way of getting into the film industry. Now that you've had some big successes like Nightmare on Elm Street, are you trying to get out of that genre?
Well, I would love for people to say, you know, filmmaker Wes Craven instead of horror film director. So to that extent, to the extent that I would like to feel less bounded, that I could have people come to me with projects that are not considered a horror film, that's important to me. I hate being restricted by myself, by other people's concept of me. So, yeah, I would like to get out of horror films. I would never have liked to have been in them. I don't like my films, as I said, classified as horror films, per se. They're films. They're Wes Craven films.
You know, well, Wes Craven, you are from, I understand, from a fundamentalist Baptist background, and you had a pretty strict upbringing. And the
way that explains it all.
No. I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you. No.
I'm smiling.
No, okay. No, but I wonder, you know, if... it does seem to me, however, that you did kind of get a chance to unleash some pent-up feelings when you got into the horror film genre. I mean, for a man who didn't even get to see any movies till he was in college, you really went at it once you got into them yourself.
That's true. And I'm sure that did have a real, very profound influence on my energies and mind. You know, it's a lifestyle. I mean, I don't want to defame any religion or religious posture, but it is one based on, a view of the world that is very dark, very prescriptive, proscriptive, and, can leave you with a tremendous sense of rage once you're out of it, because you feel like you've been denied your youth, your joy. To religion, this is all our righteousness is like filthy rags. I mean, if you look at yourself like that, you have a very dark view of yourself, and you have a very dark, almost throwaway view of the entire world. And it's something that I've had to grow out the rest of my life, grow out of, you know.
What made you fall in love with movies when you started to see them?
They're so beautiful. I don't know. I always had an active dream life, and there's something so profound and wonderful about a movie. It's so alive. It's so shared. The thing of sitting in an audience and going into a dreamlike state with several hundred other people that are sharing exactly what you're feeling is a profound event. I think it's really, to me, it simply was something that nothing else quite did for me. And it also was something that I proved after many years of sort of searching for a voice. I mean, I did many things in my life. I painted and I played guitar and wrote and did many, many things. But it all seemed to come together in making movies, and almost accidentally. I was pursuing a career in writing and went to New York to make movies almost out of desperation of finding something that I really felt happy at. And all of a sudden, I just was good at it really fast. I made my first feature, a year and a half after not knowing anything about making a movie whatsoever. So it simply was there, and I was there, and we crossed, and it was love at first sight between me and movies.
You're working on a new film now, The Serpent and the Rainbow. That's based on a book of the same name, about a Harvard graduate student who goes down to Haiti and uncovers what he thinks is the biological secret behind zombies. At least
yes.
That's what the book was about. I haven't seen the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So you were shooting on location in Haiti, and I can't think of many films that have been shot there. There's been a lot of political upheaval there lately. Did that affect the making of the film at all?
Yes. First of all, let me just thumbnail the movie. Wade Davis was a Harvard ethnobotanist, and he was commissioned by a large pharmaceutical company in a rather secret expedition to go to Haiti and find the botanical reason behind the creation of zombies. And I just wanted to say about zombies, I mean, as soon as you say the word, it's you think B-movies and think of, you know, Boris Karloff or whatever. Recently, several zombies have been discovered. That is, people who were authenticated having died and been buried and later found alive. I personally met one, 17-year-old zombie, quote, by the name of Rosemary. What they are, as it turned out after extensive research, is people that have been poisoned by a very subtle, very powerful neurotoxin that gives them all appearances of death. Their heartbeat, their respiration, and all other vital signs go down to the point where they cannot be determined by a typical rural doctor. The person is buried, and in the middle of the night is still alive, still fully conscious, although showing no signs of life, is dug back up, further poisoned, beaten, and quite often sold into slavery in Haiti and for the work in the cane fields, all part of a tribal system of judgment. It's their form of capital punishment within voodoo. So rather than thinking of zombies, think of somebody who's been poisoned by a neurotoxin and appeared to be dead but was not and has then returned to the living as a brain-damaged person with all of their volitional centers destroyed. That is what a zombie truly is. And this movie is about that actual factual process. The process existed for centuries and then was distorted by Duvalier, Papadoc Duvalier, and used as a tool of political oppression. If you spoke out too harshly against his government, you would be dragged from your house in the middle of the night and created, made into a zombie. And there could be no more compelling or terrifying symbol of the power of Duvalier than a person who wished for freedom suddenly turned into a zombie, which has no will whatsoever. So this movie is about that process, and it's quite a factual movie, but it's set within the world of real voodoo and has that sort of phantasmagoric element to it, because voodoo goes very freely into the subconscious and into the netherworld between life and death.
What was it like filming in Haiti?
Filming in Haiti was bifold. I mean, on one hand, the Haitian people are some of the most beautiful and gracious people I've ever met. And taken individually, they're wonderful, marvelous people. Within a group of more than six or eight, they can very quickly develop a sense of outrage and wanting to tear the house down because they've been oppressed so severely. So that when we were dealing with large crowds, and we had some scenes dealing with 4,000 people, we ended up in very dangerous situations. We ended up once having to evacuate our crew into a missionary compound in a small village far removed from any help. And the producer and I had to go out and deal with 4,000 chanting, very angry people who were started picking up stones and threatened to destroy us and our equipment and everything else. I mean, they are very unhappy, rightfully so, people. And it was a very, a very volatile situation.
Were you perceived as the exploiter, as the filmmaker there?
Not at first. I mean, we went in with, with all attempts to say we are bringing work and jobs and everything else. But what happened is an unfortunate event of the people have been deprived for so long that that any show of money whatsoever becomes sort of what they perceive as the beginning of the gold mine opening up.
One last question. You know, a lot of your movies have probably are about dreams and have probably affected the dreams of the people who've gone to see them. And I wonder if your dreams are ever affected by the movies that you're making.
They always are. I mean, as I said, I have an active dream life, and I don't say that glibly. I, over the years, have developed my process of dreaming to the point that it is functional. And when I'm working on a script or a movie, that filters right down into my dreams, and I quite often dream quite intact and usable portions of films, sometimes quite sizable portions of films or scenes, and it was a natural progression as that developed for my films to get more and more into the dream state.
Can you give us an example of a... Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's just the concept of Nightmare on Elm Street came out of my own dreams. The whole structure of Hills of Eyes, for instance, came out of one dream.
What was the dream?
Well, the dream was specifically started with the concept of the two dogs, Beauty and the Beast. And from that spread out to a concept of that there would be two forces represented in the film. That would be the bestial and the beautiful, and that they would intertwine to the extent that each family would mirror the other. There would be a father in each, there'd be a mother in each, there'd be children in each, there'd be pet animals in each. And at a certain point, the polarity would switch, so that what was perceived as the good family would become the evil family. What was the gentle family would become the savage family. And vice versa, the savage family at certain points would take on pathos. And, that concept of turning the duality around and around until you no longer felt comfortable thinking that there was a duality you could deal with and had to look at things in the round. That was the basic concept that came out of the dream. It was very clear-formed, and it became sort of the backbone of the structure of the film.
Do you ever have nightmares based on movies that you're working on? Do your movies ever scare you?
They scare me when I'm writing them. That's about the most alone that I ever get with them. The rest of the time is a process surrounded by so many people that, you know, that you sort of lose that, and you have to struggle to maintain it so you can understand what will be scary in that gross sense. But when I'm writing, if I'm writing a scene where I'm right in the middle of it alone by myself in a dark room, somebody comes up behind me, I will jump right out of my seat because at that point they're full blown, you know. While they're still in your mind, they're the most intact and the most powerful. By the time they get onto film, they're diminished by 10,000 factors, you know. They're still pretty scary, but you should see what's in my head.
Well, what is in your head?
I get paid for telling people that.
Ah, okay. Well, Wes Craven, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Wes Craven's films include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, and Nightmare on Elm Street. His new film, The Serpent and the Rainbow, is scheduled to open on February 5th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.